Welcome to day two of the Symposium on Church and State. It's quite obvious that the word got out that I was introducing Richard John Newhouse. It's the only time that I can gather such a crowd at 8:30 in the morning. That is a joke, honestly. Way back when the symposium was in the drawing board stage, it was decided that the final morning segment was to be entitled Religion in American Public Life. And in keeping with our philosophy that the topic was going to select the presenter rather than vice versa, the choice was quite clear. Religion and American public life meant the Reverend Richard John Newhouse. And why? Well, while we were well aware and really quite grateful that there's an ever-increasing number of informed and quite articulate thinkers and writers in our land who are providing some excellent and stimulating commentary on the subject of American and religion and American public life, we were also convinced that to assess the subject in a helpful manner requires that one make the right connection between the two. Not everybody does that. Richard John Newhouse does. But it also means that one identifies what is meant by religion and what one means by public life. Richard John Newhouse has done that clearly, prophetically, and unequivocally for years. But there's something more important than all of that. It requires that one engages in a evaluative process, a prioritization, a weighing, that one asks the question, which comes first? Does one weigh more than the other? Well, we knew of no one who is doing more to ensure that the evaluative process, the prioritization, the weighing, if you will, remains a crucial element in the elucidative and analytical process than Richard John Newhouse. And lest there be any doubt about his commitment to that evaluative process, he has launched a new publication. And he didn't tell me to give a commercial, but he's publishing a journal of religion and public life with the intriguing and very unambiguous title, First Things. Let me read a sentence, or maybe even two. Page 7, Volume 1. Religion that is captive to public life is of little public use. Indeed, such captivity produces politicized religion and religionized politics, and the result, as we know from bitter historical experience, is tragedy for both religion and public life. Authentic religion keeps the political enterprise humble by reminding it that it is not the first thing. Although that article bears no author's name, there's little doubt in my mind that those words come from the pen of Richard John Newhouse. And there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that a major clue to the authenticity of his words doesn't come so much from the fact that he served in the administration of two chief executive officers of our land, Presidents Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, but rather than from the fact that for 17 years he served God's people in a pastorate in Brooklyn, New York. But you've paid to hear Richard, not me, as dearly as I'd love to wax eloquently and at length about only a fraction of the things that should be said about this alumnus of Concordia Seminary, whom in 1988 U.S. News and World Report named one of the 32 most influential intellectuals in America. Well, I'll tell you, I didn't have to read that in U.S. News and World Report. I knew that 40 years ago. I went to high school with Richard. In fact, I first met him in the fall of 1951 in the basement of Meissner Hall, a building that no longer exists, but at that time it was a high school dormitory on the campus of Concordia Teachers College, Seward, Nebraska, where Richard was using the end of a pool table for a podium as he led an evening devotion on St. Paul's injunction to the Thessalonians, pray without ceasing. I was 13 years old, and I can probably remember more words from that devotion than from most sermons I heard before or since. From there, he went on to give us the Lutheran Forum letter, to write Freedom for Ministry, still widely read by serious students of pastoral theology, most recently The Catholic Moment, and what is certain to be a classic of religion and democracy in America, The Naked Public Square. And I am thrilled and I am honored to give to you, caring pastor, prophetic author, and commentator, the Reverend Richard John Newhouse.
Thank you so very much. Meissner Hall, Seward, Nebraska. Really? You never told me that. You'll have to tell me sometime what I did say. What a marvelous introduction. I think it was Lyndon Johnson, whenever he received a particularly generous introduction, would say, I wish my parents had been here to hear that. My father would have so enjoyed it, and my mother would have believed it. But thank you, Skip. I want to talk about the ambiguities of Christian America, and I'll begin with a text. From the epistle to Diognetus, you recall a second, some say third century letter written by some anonymous Christian to an inquirer. And he was explaining to this Diognetus how it is with the Christians. And there's this passage that has everything to do with the subject of this symposium. He writes, though the Christians are residents at home in their own countries, their behavior is more like transients. They take their full part as citizens, but they also submit to anything and everything as if they were aliens. For them, any foreign country is a homeland, and any homeland a foreign country. Well, that explanation from the second century seems to me to be remarkably pertinent to our situation at the end of the 20th century. Obviously, there are many differences that give rise to the ambiguities of our thinking about Christian America. There are many Christians who believe earnestly. Frequently, their earnestness motored by an enormous sense of resentment that this is a Christian country, and that in some sense, the Christians in this country have been disenfranchised in their own land. And so we have become familiar, especially over the last 10, 15 years, to the frequently angry rhetoric against secular humanism. That cabal, that conspiracy, that devious enterprise that has presumably stolen Christian America from the Christians. There is a sense in which this is Christian America, obviously. Sociologically and historically, if you try to locate within world historical frameworks, the cultural framework, the streams from which this polity, this set of habits of mind and heart, this democratic vision, clearly is grounded in that part of the world historical scene called Christian, or biblical, or Judeo-Christian, as some would prefer. And so, sociologically and historically, it makes sense to talk about Christian America. It makes sense to remind ourselves that we live at a time in which the religious component of the cultural formation of the West, and most particularly of this society, is becoming ever more adamant in its insistence to be heard. And that's good. We live in unsecular America. And that's both good and bad. There are ambiguities about that. Those of us who are viewed as being in the religion business, a way in which we don't like to be viewed, but a way in which we are viewed, are expected, of course, to stand up and cheer at the vibrancy of religion in this society, a society that seems to be incorrigibly and increasingly religious in character. And yet we cannot unambiguously stand up and cheer, or at best can offer but a cheer and a half. For religion is as riddled with human evil and potential for criminal behavior as any other dimension of human life, as we Lutherans well know. Our suspicion of homo incurvatus est, of man turned in upon himself against the purposes of God, never becomes so evident as when we try to use the things of God, which is to say religion, in order to advance our own agendas. And so to say that America is unsecular and that religion is vibrantly alive in America is not necessarily unqualified good news. But it is a fact about the society of which we are part, a fact which is not taken seriously, indeed, which is dismissed contemptuously by many of the people in charge of the control centers of our cultural self-consciousness. For 200 years, going back to the 1789, the French Revolution, and out of it the militantly anti-religious Enlightenment impulse in Western history, for that long, long period of time, the elites of our culture, also here in the United States, were taught to believe, were miseducated to think, that as people become more enlightened, inevitably religion would wither away, would become either less important or could be safely confined to the so-called private sphere of life. That has not happened. Most emphatically, it has not happened here in the United States. The hegemony of the secular Enlightenment, the assumption that a thoroughly secularized materialistic definition of reality would suffice for public and perhaps even personal life, that hegemony is collapsing all around our ears. In every discipline, in every field, in the sciences, hard and soft, in philosophy, in ethics, in political philosophy, most importantly, in terms of our subject. If one looks at the world map, Gallup and other organizations have done an international, transcultural survey of religiousness, the indices of religiousness around the world, measured in terms of what people say they believe, in terms of behavior and the usual things that are measurable by the resources of survey research. And what you discover if you look around the world is that perhaps the most religious society in the world is India, riddled through and through, pervasively religious, that is, reality defined in cognitive worlds premised upon supernatural transcendent assumptions. Very close to India, almost right next to it, is the United States of America, interestingly enough. Presumably the vanguard society of modern enlightenment post-industrial society. Way down at the bottom, in terms of all the criteria of religiousness, Sweden, good Lutheran land, a piece of our heritage about which we have to have very ambivalent feelings indeed. But my friend Peter Berger points out, and I think it more than a humorous way of putting it is very insightful, that in light of this data, what one could say is
the heart of the cultural crisis in American life is that America is a nation of Indians ruled by an elite of Swedes. Just something worth pondering. And it is therefore understandable that the Indians are restless and indeed increasingly aggressive and public about their resentment of the Swedes who are running their country. As much as one can share, and I do share, a great sympathy for that resentment, for the fact that in our public life, the only respectable bigotry left is anti-religious bigotry. That the only legally and culturally approved exclusion of arguments and convictions and passions from the public arena is the exclusion of those that are tainted by religion. And as much as one may share, then, that sense of there being something radically wrong, I would at the same time suggest that the answer is not the reconstruction or the reconstitution of Christian America based somehow upon biblical principles or biblical law. What we as Lutherans bring to this moment of conflict that might aptly be described as a Kulturkampf, as a war over the definition of the culture of which we are part. What we as Lutherans bring to this, it seems to me, is a sense that there will always be a Kulturkampf, is a sense that the problematics of religion and public life, of church and state, of moral judgment and transcendent warrant and public policy implementation, that all these questions, these clusters of questions, are by definition unresolvable. We do not look for a resolution of these problems. We Lutherans don't. For we, like the letter to Dionysius, we understand that we are permanently alien citizens, and that there is no satisfactory resolution until it is consummated in the establishment of the rule of God, in the kingdom of God. And therefore, we Lutherans, it seems to me, often accused of quietism as we are, often accused of a kind of fatalistic resignation to the way things are, often accused of a kind of pious passivity in the face of history's horror, and all these accusations indeed can be supported from historical evidence of the Lutheran experience. Nonetheless, we Lutherans have a strength. And that is that we understand that we're in this for the duration. We understand that we are not going to get things together in a satisfactory manner until God has gotten things together in terms of history's completion and vindication in the coming of the kingdom. To put it differently, we Lutherans have a strength in that we can engage in the public spheres of responsibility with a sense of divine imperative, but without illusions, that we do not need the illusions that we are establishing the kingdom of God or resolving the necessary conflicts between the ultimate and the penultimate with respect to the loyalties of God's people, who are always, again, alien citizens. It means that we are distinct from the monists. We are surrounded by monists. Monists on the left, monists on the right, when it comes to the questions of religion and public life. And what do I mean by monists? I mean people who want there to be a smooth coherence, a tolerable fit between biblical proclamation and political implementation. The people who want something like Christian America, frequently appearing on the right, but not always on the right of the political spectrum, also on the left. Among our evangelical friends, if you look at the Reconstructionist movement, a major force within evangelical and fundamentalist Christianity today, associated with names such as R.J. Rushdoony, generally viewed as being on the right, the idea of reclaiming Christian America as a nation based upon Bible law. But then one looks at the so-called evangelical left, Sojourners Magazine, The Other Side, Evangelicals for Social Action. What does one see there? Similar to what one sees in the Reconstructionist movement, and a set of assumptions revealed in Jim Wallace of Sojourner's book, Politics for a Biblical People, the whole assumption being that there is a biblical politics, which it is only up to Christians to have the nerve enough and the faith enough and the boldness enough to move into the public arena and implement. Monism. Monism of pre-Vatican II Rome, that there is such a thing as a Catholic state, which prior to the Second Vatican Council was exemplified in Spain, in Franco-Spain, as the thesis, in America as the only tolerable exception to be allowed in necessity. Since Vatican Council II, the Roman Catholic Church has, I think, solidly moved, at least at the level of its formal magisterial teaching, into a position alongside Lutherans in recognizing that the out-of-syncness of church and society, of the community of faith and the community of coerced public order, that out-of-syncness is for the duration. And that our task is not to relax the tension between the two, but our task is primarily to prepare the Christian people to live creatively and to make positive contributions within that context of continuing and assumed tension. And of course, there are secular monists of all varieties, for it is also a kind of monism that would create what someone has called the naked public square, that would eliminate and exclude religiously grounded and religiously articulated moral argument in the public arena, because they want, the militant secularists do, a smooth line of reasoning by which public life can be ordered without interference from other realms, other worlds, other authorities, other visions of what it means to be human. And of course, for them, in their view, no other vision, no other world is so disturbing, so intolerable, so absolutely in need of being exorcised from the public square as the notion that there is a kingdom and that there is a Lord that transcends all the lordships of human calculation of our ordered life together. And so there are monisms on the left and monisms on the right, religious monisms, militantly secular monisms. And over against all of them, we must say, as said to that person long before Luther, about 1400 years before Luther, but he said it with a nice two kingdoms kind of intuition, didn't he? That we are alien citizens. It's not necessarily a singularly Lutheran insight that helps to remind us. Thoroughly biblical, thoroughly Catholic, thoroughly articulated within the great tradition of creed and confession, but brought to a particular expressed level of cogency within the Lutheran tradition, the Lutheran understanding of the twofold way in which the one God rules his one creation, the way in which we find ourselves caught between the now and the not yet, between the promised and the present, and in which we do not see this as a problem to be resolved, but rather as a journey to be faithfully completed. For we are in this for the duration, and have no illusion that we will get things together before God has gotten things together in the coming of his kingdom. And so we Lutherans unapologetically talk two languages, two traditions when it comes to religion and public life, to church and state, to the community of the redeemed and the sanctified, and the community of those mercifully upheld by God's orders of creation and preservation. We do not try to conflate these. We do not try to confuse these. We do not try to take the imperatives and the visions appropriate to the community called to the allegiance of Christ and to implement them in the order of Caesar. We are frankly dualistic. Dualism is a dirty word in our time. The monists don't like it. They hate it. Monism is the dominant mood in this Gnostic culture that wants to persuade us if we only get our consciousness properly raised and in touch with our feelings, we will discover a holistic, how often do we hear that word? In every field, every discipline, every enterprise, people want a holistic approach, including an holistic approach to questions of religion and public life. And we say, sorry, there are none available. At least there are none available that are faithful to the biblical witness. There are none available that are not terribly dangerous, both to biblical religion and to the public sphere. We live in a dualistic, a torn, a tension-ridden, dialectic, if you will. And we Lutherans ought to be practiced at that, understanding the dialectic of law and gospel, most fundamentally of nature and grace, the civil realm and the realm of God's saving purposes in Jesus Christ. And we ought boldly to assert that against those who will say, and there are many who do say now, and have been saying, lo, these 45 years since the end of World War II, that the Lutheran twofold ethic has been discredited once and for all, devastatingly so, by the experience of Nazi Germany and the sorry record of German Lutherans. And I would put to you that while for the most part Lutheranism in Germany did establish a sorry, indeed tragic record of failure, it was precisely a failure to assert boldly the understanding of the twofold rule of the one God over his one world. It was the cowardice of people who drew back, admittedly under circumstances so dire that we are cautioned not to be excessively judgmental, but nonetheless drew back from the bold assertion that God in both law and gospel holds the entirety of his creation to account. Interestingly enough, in the period of the Third Reich. Third Reich. Those who did have a politically innovative word to say were largely the monists who abandoned Lutheran Two Kingdom thought. If you look at the Deutsche Christen, the so-called German Christians, Immanuel Hirsch and others, who tried to find, well, not only tried to find, indeed constructed what they thought to be a theological legitimation of National Socialism, of Hitler's ascendancy to power. They were precisely the Lutherans, if you will, who abandoned the Lutheran twofold understanding. They were precisely, if you will, the Christian Reconstructionists of their time, or the liberation theologians of their time, who tried to bring into a politically usable synthesis their understanding of biblical faith and of God's workings in history with what they believed to be the most promising political direction of their time. I recall some years ago, an Episcopal bishop friend who wrote a book about being a bishop, and he was describing the difficult decisions he had to make from time to time in terms of taking a radical or a prophetic, as he viewed it, position on this question or that. And he said, I've always followed the counsel of the bishop who ordained me years ago, who said, whenever you're in doubt, go with the future. Very interesting advice. Whenever in doubt, put your finger in the air and see where the future is going. Well, of course, I pointed out to him that in 1932 or 33 in Germany, he certainly then would have been among the Deutsche Christen. For there was no doubt that the wave of the future, the great thing that presumably God was doing in history, was National Socialism. Just as today, our still untempered Christian Marxist friends and proponents of liberation theology have no doubt, I hope, that since the revolution of 1989, some of them will begin to become more public about their doubts. But still to this date, they read the signs of the times, as it is said, and they discern God's purposes in history, and they go with the future. The alternative to going with the future in that naive sense, which is a sure formula for disaster, both political and moral, the alternative for that, to that, is not to go with the past, nor to stick with the present. But the alternative is a genuine discernment that always recognizes the out-of-syncness, the dialectic, the appearing paradoxes and contradictions between our understanding of God's revealed purposes in Jesus Christ and the course of history's unfoldings. There are few times in which we can say historically, thus saith the Lord, with respect to particular options thrown up within the turmoil of political life. There are times in which we can say no emphatically. And the confessing church, to revert again to the experience of the Third Reich, the confessing church of the Barman Declaration of 1934, was primarily a saying no to an evil and pagan and explicitly anti-Christian proposition that was being advanced. It was admittedly a saying no in the light of a prior yes to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Once we have said Christ is Lord, we have said implicitly that everyone and everything else is not Lord, and most particularly in the political realm, we have said Caesar is not Lord. and there are times in which that must be said explicitly. And Barman was such a time. We Lutherans have a strength coming out of the Third Reich, therefore, I would say, coming out of that experience, even we, if you will, who trace our particular tradition in terms of Germanic Lutheranism. There were lessons learned and a tempering that took place. And I would warmly recommend today to any young seminarian theologian trying to think through the sometimes they seem like impossible questions of religion and public life, of biblical faith and moral judgment and political responsibility, trying to think through those questions, such a student could do no better than to go back and to read again or for the first time or for the fourth time Bonhoeffer's Ethics. An ethics firmly and wisely shaped in the crucible of two kingdoms thought, in a time that was indeed a crucible for the testing of that thought. We are for the duration, we Lutherans are, and we are unapologetically dualistic against all of the monisms of the world. Genuine democratic pluralism depends upon dualism. It depends upon an acknowledgement that nobody has the correct fit between the ultimacies of God's self-revelation in Christ and the penultimacies of the ordering of our political life. And indeed, usually not only penultimacies, but pre-penultimacies and less than that. Of course, this means that public life, the ordering of the polis, of the city of man, will always be for us an unsatisfactory business. There are Christian reconstructionists of the left and of the right who say, Newhouse, you rob politics of its redemptive significance. You rob the political vocation of its sense of religious seriousness. You rob the political enterprise of the hope for its fulfillment. I don't rob any of them of any of that, for they never possessed it rightly to begin with. Politics is the hard work of trying to maintain. For the most part, it is a maintenance project. Those elementary understandings, sometimes embodied in law, more securely and more importantly embodied in habits and in cultural predispositions, that help to make and to keep life reasonably decent in the face of human capacity for unspeakable and bloody evil. Politics is not only the art of the possible, as is commonly said, it is also the art of finding out what may be possible, how the life of the polis, of the city of man, might be better ordered, more justly ordered. Indeed, there is high adventure in it, and all the challenges required to fully occupy human capacities for courage and daring and imagination and collaboration. And yet, after saying all of that, it is not satisfactory and never will be. It is second best. Everything is second best compared to the city from which we are born and to which our journey wends, the city of God, in which questions of faith and moral judgment and right ordering will once and satisfactorily be resolved. Here now in a provisional way, here now in a tentative way, here now in a way that is always fallible, in a way that will always be filled with disappointments and sometimes with disillusionments. Here now we try to make those connections in this time between the times, between Christian faith and moral judgment and the implementation of that in law and public policy. And here we have to contend against, again, all the monists of all different varieties, most particularly against those secular monists who say that your very enterprise of trying to make the connections between biblical faith and moral judgment and public policy, that very enterprise is illegitimate. That very enterprise is a violation of church and state. That very enterprise is your effort to impose upon others who do not share your religious belief the implications of your religious belief. And that is a grievous offense against a pluralistic and democratic society. That is what they say. And we must quietly but firmly and as lovingly but unequivocally as possible say in response that all concern about the right ordering of the polis and all of the legislating of laws and the implementation of laws, all of that is an imposing of judgments. Law is by very definition an imposing of a judgment. It is by very definition an imposing of a moral judgment. Indeed, the political enterprise is inescapably a moral enterprise, not moral, of course, in the sense that those who engage in it behave morally or are concerned about moral ends. But politics itself is, as Aristotle rightly said, the question of free deliberation over how ought we to order our life together. And the word ought there clearly indicates the moral character of the political enterprise. So a political process that is democratic and pluralistic is not one in which no moral judgments or value judgments, as some prefer to call them, are imposed. But it is rather that those are imposed which are legitimated by the people through the democratic institutional processes of deliberation, of contestation, in many cases of election. It is the setting up of a polity that assumes, as this American polity does, that there will be multiple sources of moral judgment in play, all perhaps, for the most part, vaguely biblical, vaguely Judeo-Christian in character, but nonetheless from multiple sources will these judgments arise then to enter into contestation in the political arena. And in respectful accord with the democratic institutions designed to protect minority viewpoints, then they will indeed be implemented, which is to say they will be imposed through legislation, through the interpreting of legislation, through specific regulation and public policy acting out. This is in the nature of what government is about, the making of connections between moral judgment about what ought to be, what is fair, what is just? What is equitable? These are all moral questions, these political questions, these judicial questions. And making the connections between those moral judgments and public policies and laws, that will be the ongoing task of political actors. And where they draw, from what wells they draw, from what fonts of wisdom or barbarity they draw their moral judgments, that is beyond the purview of the state. The separation of church and state does not mean the separation of public life from the sources of moral deliberation. in a society that, however confusedly, thinks of itself as Christian. Well over 85-95% of the American people, all the survey research down through the decades demonstrates this, and it is becoming more the case rather than less the case, assume that religion is the source of morality. However confusedly that is put, when asked what is the source of morality, it's uniformly, almost across the board, the answer is the Bible, Christianity, the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, the teaching of the church, etc., etc. This is filled with ambiguities, for we Lutherans know how devious it is when religion is identified primarily in terms of morality. We know how devious it is when people assume that to be religious is to be moral, and that somehow that is not only the source of moral judgment relevant to public policy, but also the source from which we constitute our relationship to God. What a hard road a hoe we Lutherans have to keep those law-gospel distinctions in play in a society such as this, so pervasively and confusedly Christian, and so very confusedly, with tragic confusion, mixing that understanding of being Christian with that understanding of righteousness, not only in the public realm, but righteousness before God. But what we must do in a preliminary way, penultimate to our preaching of law and gospel, which is the main thing we must always be doing, we must help those of our fellow citizens, Christian or Jewish or non-believers or militant secularists, or however they wish to identify themselves, we must help them to understand anew that they are engaged, as much as we are engaged, in drawing upon moral sources to form judgments relevant to the right ordering of our life together. That everybody is engaged, at least who is engaged in this task, is engaged in imposing those judgments in the public square. And the only question is whether we do that in a way that is in accord with the institutions and the intuitions of this democratic polity, or whether we do that in a manner that some of our monist friends, also our Christian monist friends, also on the left as well as on the right, would do it, which is finally to gain enough Christian firepower in the political arena to override or even to discard this democratic polity. We Lutherans who are in this for the duration, we Lutherans who are in this without illusion about building the kingdom of God or hurrying its consummation in history, we Lutherans who have no millennialistic dreams that inflate the political task in history, we Lutherans have every reason to affirm a political order, a polity, the polity of this constitutional United States of America, as being something that is congruent with our Lutheran understanding of the ongoing task of seeking the right ordering of the polis. Against the Reconstructionists of the left and of the right, against the liberation theologians, against the nihilists of much contemporary political philosophy, we believe, it seems to me we should believe, with Reinhold Niebuhr in his justly famed statement, that democracy is possible because of man's capacity for justice, but democracy is necessary because of man's proclivity to evil. That is a tempered, considered affirmation of the liberal democratic proposition. One that is tempered because no social order, past, present, or proposed, can ever meet the Christian criteria of the justice that God intends for his human community. And therefore, even of this relatively good, relatively just order, it is always a tempered affirmation that we offer, but an affirmation nonetheless, because it accords with our understanding of both the human capacity for civil good, for civil righteousness, if you will, and of the human inclination to great evil. Federalist paper number 10 is in many ways, it seems to me, although written by a Jemmy Madison who obviously was no theologian, nonetheless a statement of great theological, intuitive wisdom as to how it is the people ought to order their life together for the duration. How in a time in which we are in conflict over some of the most important definitions of what is true, morally and otherwise, we can nonetheless prevent in principle that conflict from working its way out into the most lethal kind of confrontation. There are the monists among us who say that's a wimpish kind of Christianity. What you ought to do, what we ought to do, what Christians are called to do, is to claim the crown rights of King Jesus. That's the language of dominion theology, of Reconstructionism. And if Christians only had the nerve for it, if they were only bold enough, if they were only faithful enough in a society like this, they could seize power. Maybe they could. But it is not because we are wimps, but because we are obedient, that we say it is precisely that that we must not do, that we must not try to do. We do not have such a sure, lucid, irrefutable understanding of God's will for the ordering of the civil realm that we dare demean the name of God by invoking it in order to impose our desires. That is a course of faithfulness, not of wimpishness. We do not kill those who disagree with us about the will of God because we believe it is the will of God that we not kill those who disagree with us about the will of God. And so all orders will be unsatisfactory. We who have signed on for the duration, who in our baptisms were signed on for the duration until the coming of that kingdom for which alone our hearts and our hopes are fitted. But between now and then, there are many arguments to be made. There are many great battles to be fought. There are many new communities of discourse, a more elevated discourse to be created, as we with those who are and those who are not in Christ understand ourselves to be in a historical moment that at least we Christians are prepared to say is subject to the will of the God revealed in Jesus Christ. And therefore, these political tasks in this historical moment, as provisional as it be, these political tasks are to be undertaken with great seriousness, but not total seriousness. They are to be undertaken with a sense of enormous responsibility, but not ultimate responsibility. For it is with us, as in the second century, that anonymous writer said it was with Christians then. Though they are residents at home in their own countries, their behavior is more like that of transients. They take their full part as citizens, but they also submit to anything and everything as if they were aliens. For them, any foreign country is a homeland, and any homeland, a foreign country. For they were, we are, alien citizens. Thank you.
I would wish that all of you one day would have the delightful experience that I've just had to introduce a presenter who proves your introduction was no lie. Thank you, Richard. We have 19 minutes. If you will limit your questions to one, we will go alternately by microphone, except the priority to the two gentlemen at the microphone on my right, Jim.
Thank you very much. You spoke of minority voices in America, and this raises the question of how firmly rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition our democratic state is, and if it is firmly and perhaps inextricably rooted that way, what does that mean for minority voices such as Muslims, Hindus, and even atheists who are not rooted in that same tradition at all?
We don't know what yet will be the impact of Islam and of some of the religions of the East, which we in our cultural naivete call new religions that are obviously very old. It will grow. Already, presumably, there are more Muslims in the United States than there are Episcopalians, which is an interesting thing to contemplate as a sign of hope or discouragement. I don't know. Someone asked me the other day, purely an aside, they put it this way, in terms of how do you become an entitled minority in American life? And I've often made the point that you have to have quite a bit of power to be certified as powerless in America. And you have to have a lot of clout to become a minority. And to become a victim really takes a good deal of political influence. But someone said, you know, if you think of American life, there are 52% of the population is female, 28% of the population is Roman Catholic, 12% of the population is black, about 12% of the population is Hispanic, about 1.5% of the population is Episcopalian. Which of the above groups does not think of itself as a minority? It's interesting to contemplate. My thought is that so far, Islam and other religious groups have demonstrated very little interest in challenging. Now, maybe in part because they've not been in a position to challenge what we take to be the Judeo-Christian fundaments of this society and of this constitutional order. Whether that will come or not, I don't know. I rather doubt it, quite frankly, because the overwhelming force culturally shaping the political life of this country will continue to be, it seems to me, Judeo-Christian. And there is not in Islam, historically, any resource or any tradition of reflection, literature, whatever, in support of a democratic polity. Indeed, one of the great challenges, it seems to me, of the 21st century
one of the great questions, especially now if the Cold War is over, might well be the reconfiguration of world historical politics in terms of the challenge posed by Islam to what would believe to be, or what would seem to be, the tide of democratic revolution in the world. So I don't expect that this is going to be a major problem in American life. To the extent that these communities are more fully engaged, more fully participant, I expect they will culturally assimilate the presuppositions of a Judeo-Christian culture. The larger question is the growing Hispanic influence in American life, and therefore the which is, of course, overwhelmingly at present Roman Catholic, and is a major contributing factor in terms of the growth of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States, but which is also becoming increasingly the milieu for the growth of evangelical and fundamentalist Protestantism, both in Latin America, Central America, and increasingly in the immigration to this country. So we have to worry, it seems to me, in terms of looking to the future configuration, the demographics, if you will, of the American population, to strengthening the Roman Catholic and evangelical fundamentalist understanding of the theological and biblical legitimations of this democratic order.
Thank you.
Good morning. I have a news release from Concordia Seminary, which I received several weeks ago. On the second page of it, it said, "The question of the proper relationship between church and state has captivated public attention for centuries. In 1839, the Saxon immigration, which brought the founders of Concordia Seminary to the United States, was fueled by pressure from the King of Prussia to abandon their doctrinal heritage and merge with more liberal groups. So an examination of the topic of church and state is particularly relevant for Concordia Seminary as it closes its two-year celebration of its 150th anniversary." The concern here was the intrusion of the state upon the church in Germany. I see the same thing today of the intrusion of the state in this country into churches and church organization and Christian principles. Now, this is done a little differently than in Germany. It's done through the grants of money to churches, church hospitals, colleges, Altenheim, Bethesda Home, and so forth. Some years ago, I was talking to the administrator of the Lutheran Altenheim here in St. Louis, Mr. Willis Peel, and he said that the money that they receive from the government has more restrictions and more controls on it and more red tape than what you get from private donations. The government, with its money, has regulations which go with this. And so I see a danger there of accepting the government money that you also accept the regulations and they have influence upon the church. And besides this here soft kind of intrusion of the government on the church, you have the attacks upon religion through grants to such organization of the National Endowment for the Arts. I assume you're familiar with some of the things that they have financed. It seems to me that there has not been sufficient attention paid to this portion of the program of the intrusion of the state upon the churches, and I'd like for you to address that and what would be the Christian response to this intrusion, both the subtle one through money and the other one, of the upon the churches by the government. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I generally agree with you that the churches have been not as reflective or self-critical as they ought to have been about the use of governmental funds, especially in the social service areas, medicine, nursing homes, etc. Frequently, these institutions have, for all practical purposes, become more attuned to the requirements of government funding than to the constituting purposes for which they were brought into being by the churches to begin with. And that's, I suppose, simply a gloss on the maxim that he who pays the fiddler calls the tune, and the Queen's command follows the Queen's pence, as it is put. At the same time, I'm sure that there are ways, also in the area of education, in which we can achieve a more, I think, just and fair distribution of monies devoted to education in a way that does not either handicap financially the church-related schools, and I think here particularly of elementary and high schools, and neither does it require them to sell their souls. And I think there are mechanisms proposed for doing that, such as voucher payments and tuition tax credits and other things. Now, Missouri Synod, I know, has a long history of ambivalence about the whole question of church funding, and I think that's perhaps a necessary ambivalence. It'll continue. As to the question of the National Endowment for the Arts, it relates to what was said earlier. You know, there even some of the militantly secularist forms of advocacy in our life are Judeo-Christian in character. If one looks at the people who in Cincinnati at the moment passionately believe that personal integrity, human freedom, human fulfillment, etc., require the exhibition of sodomistic and other aberrant acts, or people who really believe that this constitutional democracy requires public funding of crucifixes submerged in urine. Why do they really believe that? To put the best construction upon it, as Luther would counsel us in the Eighth Commandment, in part their very notions of freedom of expression, of what's required for personal integrity in terms of resisting censorship, these very notions are inexplicable without reference to the Judeo-Christian tradition. They are very biblical notions, in a way, run amok. Notions of the dignity of the human person, of the need to avoid a coercive establishment of one truth over against another truth, etc. And we can help them to see that. Only in this Western culture, in this Judeo-Christian Western culture, as many of them contemptuously refer to it, are these very ideas of personal integrity, artistic expression, etc., etc., present. No other culture has the notion that it must constantly institutionalize the criticism of itself, the challenge to itself. And so here's a magnificent paradox in the way in which our culture is trying to work through these questions. What you have, and you know, there are other things that we just have to help people to see what they're doing. The same people who at the objected to the Corcoran Gallery not showing the Mapplethorpe thing are the people who on our university campuses are implementing all kinds of censorship of what they call hate speech, right, of speech that is presumably tainted by bigotry or prejudice or ethnicity or sexism or racism or ageism or classism or speciesism or one of that long, long list of things, okay? And some of our most distinguished universities are now developing guidelines, rules for the governance of the university, which censor what's called hate speech, which is speech that violates any of these criteria. Now, you talk about a violation
of free speech or free expression. You talk about the imposition of a repressive censorship system. Why is it that they believe that it is so important for the government to fund and the public to see photographs of sodomy and of piss Christ? On the one hand, in the name of freedom of expression, etc., etc. And on the other hand, in another institution, they are imposing a rigid, rigorous system of censorship. It's not so difficult to understand if one understands what the interests are at stake. Basically, in a good Niebuhrian or a good Lutheran way, we can appreciate this. People want to censor what they don't like. Gets right down to it. Sounds a little simple-minded. And there's a class differential here. And yeah, I won't go into all the ramifications of sociological theory about the new knowledge class, but there is a new knowledge class in American life which, for the most part, makes up that community of Swedes that governs the Indians. And this throws us into all kinds of peculiar situations where you have the same people railing against censorship and imposing censorship, not only them, however, also other people on the other side, railing against what they view as the censorship of religion, while wanting to impose what others view as censorship against whatever museum it is in Cincinnati at the moment. What all of us have to do, and it's a great task, and the church is in fact, it is the key mediating institution for doing this, if this is going to be done at all, it's exceedingly difficult, is to get everybody to understand that they're dealing with the question, each in his or her complex way, how ought we to order our life together? And that's what we ought to be able to deliberate about without letting the deliberation degenerate into simply sloganeering and fruitless polemics and ultimately religious warfare. Because push it far enough, and that's where it's going to end up.
In light of what you've just said, what do you believe the Christian response should be to the move by the homosexual population to be seen as a minority within our country?
I think that when one says a homosexual population, of course, one is talking about the politicized homosexual activist population, which is by no means inclusive of all people who are either in orientation or in practice homosexual. I think that the society has about as fundamental an interest in this question as you can have in any question. Because again, at the risk of sounding simple-minded, the most obvious thing to be said about homosexual relations is that they are sterile. A society's most fundamental interest is in continuing itself. A culture's most fundamental aspiration is to transmit its answer to the question of how ought we order to our life together to another generation. Therefore, any society challenged with the proposition that homosexuality, that sterility, that the death wish of making this the terminal generation ought to be legitimated by a society, is to ask a society to commit suicide. I think that Christians should, and the church should be exemplary in this, in being a community that is eager to embrace people of all the diversities of the human condition, struggling for discipleship and faithfulness to Christ. And that we ought to be in the forefront of demonstrating that gay bashing and bigotry in the sense of the degradation of other human beings has no place among us. But at the same time, it seems to me that in the Christian community,
we have to be able to say to everybody of all varieties, and goodness sake, sexual varieties is by no means the most important varieties in which human beings come, but also with respect to sexual varieties, that we are people with a standing in a community that is simul justus et peccator, not because of who we are, not because we are accepted for who we are, as the language of gay activism has it. You know, we want to be accepted for who we are. Nobody is accepted in the Christian community for who we are. We're accepted for whom we are in Christ, for the righteousness of Christ, for who Christ is. And within the community, all who come with that understanding ought to be, as I say, welcomed and embraced and given every opportunity to live out that life of discipleship and to be supported by those who understand the diversities and the conflicts and the tangled webs of human motivation, including sexuality and its drives. These things are questions on which the church ought to be as my friend Stan Hauerwa says, a community of character that is a kind of model community to the society, in which we are not like the society, constituting every relationship in terms of individualistic rights, but rather are able to build community in terms of an understanding of the limits of everything about us, including our rights, and therefore the need to be brought together by something more than simply our assertion of who we claim to be and who we want to be accepted as.
Says, Mark, if you're real lucky, I'll bet you'll catch Richard John Newhouse walking down these steps. We're going to stick with our time schedule, and there are coffee and pastries to the Wartburg or Coburg. And those of you who weren't here yesterday, just follow the crowd. Please come back. Within 30 minutes, we will begin the final session. Thank you.